It's time. Time for stimulating talk. Time for thought-provoking conversation. Time for the Lisa Wexler Show on WICC 600. Turn on your brain and get the real scoop on today's topics and events. Here is Lisa Wexler.
Hi, and welcome to the show today. Guess who I am? 203-333-9422. That's how you can be part of the show. Call me at 203-333-9422. We have a great show for you today. We're going to have like a deep dive, interesting show. I have a friend named Helen Block. I've known her for a long time. And she has one of the most extraordinary personal histories of anyone I've ever met. She was actually born in a displaced persons camp, a DP camp in Germany after the war. And she wasn't just whisked away. She was raised there until the age of 7, maybe 8. And she subsequently grew up and she had a life. And she later in life decided that what she really wanted to do was write about her life, but from a historical fiction perspective. So she wrote a book called The Shoemaker's Daughter, which got wide acclaim. And now she's actually going to be coming in the studio today because I understand she went back to Germany to speak at the DP camp in which she was born and raised for a lot of her young life. So she's coming in today to talk about that, to talk about her story, a first-person memoir, a real-life historical a real life history of somebody who can talk about how world events shape us as human beings. And she's an eloquent speaker and a dear friend. So Helen Block is coming in today. The Shoemaker's Daughter is her book. And then also, we're going to be joined by Ted Kraft. Our Eye on the Town series continues. Today, we're going to focus on the town of Weston. Town of Weston, which has just around 10,000 people and prides itself on its rural character and its resistance to further commercial development and its commitment to sustainability. So Ted Kraft has picked up where the Weston Forum left off after it went belly up. The town no longer has a print newspaper. So Ted Kraft publishes an online newspaper, and it's quickly become the go-to must-be-read in your morning inbox every day. So Ted Kraft, the editor of Weston Today, will be joining us as well. At 203-333-9422, did you watch the debate last night? I did. I watched a lot of it, and I enjoyed it because I enjoy hearing thoughtful, committed people, whether they be Republican or Democrat. I want to hear what they have to say. I want to hear the way they react to the questions thrown at them. I was impressed that there were 4 women that were the moderators of the debate, and none of them were pulling any punches. Rachel Maddow asked a question, and she said, with all due respect, thank you for your answer. Now answer the question. Andrea Mitchell was there. There were two other gals whose names I don't know offhand, but one I know was from the Washington Post. And they did their job, and they asked about the issues that matter to a lot of people, including a lot of women, like why is it that the United States and Papua New Guinea are the only places apparently on Earth that don't have any form of paid family leave? How is it that we expect to support growing and new families if we don't support working mothers? So those were important questions. And there was a range. There were questions about reproductive rights. There were questions about how climate change figures into the priorities of people. And I really enjoyed it from that point of view. So I liked the debate. I want to turn. Today is another day of the impeachment hearings. And if you're following these impeachment hearings, which millions of Americans are, you know that yesterday, Gordon Sondland's testimony. We have the audio, Christian. Gordon Sondland's testimony was notable for the way in which Gordon Sondland, despite at the beginning of his statement saying that he didn't have access to things he thought he should have access to, he really pulled no punches in terms of his testimony, with the understanding that everybody understood that there was a quid pro quo. Let's go to the audio, Christian.
Everyone was in the loop. It was no secret. Everyone was informed via email on July 19th, days before the presidential call.
Now, that's just a little bit. But if you hear the big picture, what Gordon Sondland is painting a picture of is an administration That included Mike Pompeo, the Secretary of State, who incidentally is right now, as we speak, being rumored to try and leave the White House in order to run for a seat in Kansas to become a senator. But apparently Donald Trump doesn't know that. I thought that was hilarious. It was published in Mike Allen's political newsletter, and it was actually published and said, President Trump doesn't know that Mike Pompeo was planning on leaving. Well, I guess he would know now if he read the newsletter. Anyway, Mike Pompeo, who is very close to the president, also implicated. Everybody knew it was an open secret that wasn't a secret at all, that President Trump was going to be insisting a brand new president. You know, President Zelensky, let's go back a little bit for Ukraine. President Zelensky was not a tried and true politico. He came to the presidency of Ukraine as basically a popular guy in the and not a politician. He was not somebody who was known as a politician. He had never run for office before, but he had a very high popularity index. So he was sort of a neophyte. He's making his way to try and figure out what to do best for his country, which is under siege from Vladimir Putin, the former Soviet Union wanting to rebuild the Soviet Union, Russia trying to rebuild the Soviet Union, and why not annex all of Ukraine the way it annexed Crimea, right, without even a shot being fired. They just went in and took back Crimea. You remember that. And so Ukraine feeling under siege, knowing that it needs this $400 million, Zelensky is a newbie, and he gets the message loud and clear that if he doesn't give President Trump what he wants in terms of the way that this investigation of Hunter Biden needs to proceed, that he's not going to get the money for his country. And so the real question is, because let's assume all these facts are true, and President Trump indicated and knew that there was a quid pro quo. So the real question is that a high crime or misdemeanor? Is it? And what do we mean by a high crime or misdemeanor? So I did a little research because a bunch of you have been sending me emails to lisa@lisawexler.com. And you want me to discuss, you want to know what's a high crime or misdemeanor? Why is it that the press isn't talking about this? So let me give you a little bit of background and insight as I've been learning about what we think we mean by a high crime and misdemeanor when the founders wrote that language. So you should know that the term high crime and misdemeanor really comes out of our British Commonwealth, British common law history. And the phrase itself came from this idea a long time ago that there were many different officers, judges, parliamentarians, people that were close to kings that needed to be or thought that they could be removed from office, but not because they had done anything criminal. So let me tell you exactly what high crime and misdemeanor meant. Okay. For example, in 1774, just before the American Revolution, the Massachusetts Colonial Assembly impeached their Chief Justice, Peter Oliver, for certain high crimes and misdemeanors. Now, we're going back to 1774. Do you want to know what he did that made him get thrown out of office? The decidedly non-criminal act of agreeing to accept a royal salary rather than the stipend appropriated by the Massachusetts legislature. Now, why would that be a high crime and misdemeanor in 1774? Where were we as a brand new, soon-to-be republic in 1774? Well, we were a company that was torn between loyalty to the crown and this idea of a new United States of America. And so it was considered a high crime and misdemeanor for somebody as a Chief Justice of Massachusetts to take his salary from the crown, because it implied a loyalty to the crown that the people in the newly founded state of Massachusetts, colony of Massachusetts, said, we don't want any divided loyalty. We want an undivided loyalty to us in Massachusetts. John Adams is often credited with the idea of impeaching that judge on that ground. And among those voting to impeach Oliver were Sam Adams and John Hancock, as well as Nathaniel Gorham, who in 1787 was a delegate to the Constitutional Convention and chaired its early deliberations. The founders, both during the ratification period and afterward, identified multiple non-criminal acts that they believe nonetheless to be impeachable. For example, at the Virginia ratifying convention, both James Madison and Wilson Nicholas said that an abuse of the pardon power would be impeachable. Now, why would an abuse of the pardon power be impeachable? Because a pardon power was exclusively granted to presidents and was not intended to be used for self-interest. So, in other words, let's say a president was able to get an underling to do a favor for him in the government with the quid pro quo understanding, wink, wink, that if you were convicted of a crime for doing so, don't worry, I'll get you out of jail. Does it remind you of what Roger Stone is thinking about right now? Roger Stone was just convicted of felonies in a jury trial that lasted about 7 hours, in a jury deliberation that lasted about 7 hours. And the question is, has he made a side deal with President Trump that no matter what happens to him in the sentencing, that he'll be pardoned anyway? Would that be something that would be considered an impeachable offense? If what he did was to the direct benefit of the president, the founding fathers would say yes. Yes. That's what a high crime and misdemeanor is. That's an impeachable offense. You can't abuse your pardon power. Some founders said that impeachment would follow from receipt of foreign emoluments. In other words, monies from foreign governments. Or presidential efforts to secure by trickery Senate ratification of a disadvantageous treaty. In other words, not strictly criminal behavior, but behavior that was completely unfit for somebody who was going to be a leader of this country. During the first Congress of 1789, Madison argued that presidents could be impeached for, quote, wanton removal of meritorious officers. And in the Federalist Papers, Alexander Hamilton made the larger point that impeachment is directed at political offenses that proceed from the abuse or violation of some public trust. Justice Joseph Story observed in 1833 that impeachable conduct is often purely political and that no previous statute is necessary to authorize an impeachment for any official misconduct. In other words, a high crime and misdemeanor is not a violation of criminal law. It is something that goes to the duty of loyalty, the duty of upholding the values that are commensurate with the office. The first American impeachment was of Senator William Blount in 1797. Blount had concocted a scheme to give Great Britain control of Florida and the Louisiana territories. When it was exposed, the Senate found he had committed a high misdemeanor, entirely inconsistent with his public trust and duty, and promptly expelled him. The House then impeached him in 5 articles alleging betrayals of trust and the national interest. Most authorities conclude that Blount escaped conviction only because the Senate decided that senators were not civil officers subject to impeachment. Multiple judges have been impeached and some removed for non-criminal abuses or dereliction of office. Judges John Pickering and Mark Delahaye were impeached for public drunkenness. Judges George English and Harold Lauterbach were impeached for abusive or biased behavior that brought their courts into disrepute. And the reason that we have high crimes and misdemeanors in the American Constitution is because George Mason of Virginia was unhappy that as we were finishing the Constitutional Convention, the class of impeachable offenses had been limited to treason or bribery, and Mason wanted a much broader definition. He said that treason or bribery was too skimpy, and he first suggested an addition called maladministration, but that was not accepted. So the sturdy old English term of high crimes and misdemeanors was accepted instead. So please understand that what we mean by high crimes and misdemeanors are not the misdemeanors that are found in criminal statutes. It is a term of art, high crimes and misdemeanors. And it refers to, much as we talk about a dereliction of fiduciary duty, much as we understand that when someone has a duty of trust, whether they be a conservator or a guardian or an executor or something like that in a person's life, And when they betray that trust, they need to be removed. It's the same kind of jurisprudence. It's the idea that when somebody takes an oath of office, you know, it's not about violating a criminal statute. You can be removed from office for something far lesser than that, because your duty of integrity and your duty of ethics is far higher than that. It's not a low bar of a criminal justice penal code. It's a much higher bar of obeying the public interest and upholding the public trust. And so these impeachment proceedings are about that. That's what they're about. 203-333-9422 at 21 minutes after the hour. When we return, I'm going to get into the nuts and bolts of exactly what the Senate will have to find and the threshold of passing, because there's a huge misunderstanding right now of what the Constitution means. So stick around. I'll explain it. Clarissa explains it all. No, Lisa explains it all on WICC 600 at 203-333-9422, and we will go to your calls. And welcome back to the show. Helen Block will be joining us in just a few minutes, and we'll hear her extraordinary story of having been born in a displaced persons camp in Germany, and not only born there, but having grown up there for her formative years through ages 7 or 8, and then becoming a very acclaimed author of The Shoemaker's Daughter, a historical fiction account of her family. And so we're going to hear from Helen, and it's quite a moving story, and I encourage you to stick around to hear it and be part of it. 203-333-9422. But, you know, due to popular demand, I've been trying to explain this morning a little bit about the definition of high crimes and misdemeanors. And the takeaway really is that it's not a misdemeanor the way we think about the criminal law, the penal law, and the statutes. It's a term of art. And high crimes and misdemeanors comes from the common law of England. And it has to do with betrayal of public trust. The original writing of our Constitution, well before we ratified it, said that it was only going to, that impeachment would only be for bribery or treason. And the Founding Fathers said that that was frankly too narrow, that what they were really trying to get at was not bribery or treason as very specific circumscribed crimes, but rather this idea of a betrayal of a public trust, of an acting in one's own self-interest. And if you think about it in terms of a breach of a fiduciary duty, that's really what we're getting at here. So I want to go into a little bit of something else as well, because there seems to be a lot of publication of the idea that in order to convict in the Senate, so if the impeachment, which is to say, think of it as an indictment, if the accusation moves forward from the House, which it likely will do if strictly based on the partisan nature of what we know to be our government right now. And if all the Democrats stick together, they will vote to refer this matter to the Senate, where there will be a trial. And the trial will actually be conducted by Chief Justice John Roberts. But the Chief Justice, the Supreme Court, does not have a vote in the trial. But that is who conducts the trial. And what we keep hearing is that there will never be enough votes to convict because we don't have a Senate right now that's 2/3, 67 votes, that are Democrat. And if we strictly went by partisan lines, that's what it would quote-unquote take. But the reality is the Constitution does not say that one needs 2/3 of the Senate to convict. It says it needs 2/3 of the members present to convict. And that becomes really important if this president is impeached and the trial goes before the Senate, because 2/3 of members present is not 2/3. And I can foresee a situation in which senators don't show up. The presumption is that all senators will want to be there for the impeachment of a president. Not so fast. There may be quite a few senators who decide for strictly political reasons that they don't want to be counted, that they don't want to be there. And to the extent that even one senator doesn't show up, the 2/3 number shrinks. It shrinks, you do the math. If 80 senators show up, two-thirds of 80 senators is not 67. It's a heck of a lot less. So I just want to let you know that the Constitution is as clear can be. It is not two-thirds of the entire Senate. It is two-thirds of the members present for the vote on impeachment that have to convict. Let's go to Carol from Stratford. Hi, Carol. Welcome to the show today. Hi.
Well, thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate your explanations. I have a question with regard to Hunter Biden's role as a board member of this large energy company. What does a board member do? What are their duties? How do you get to be a board member? And I really don't understand the role of a member of a large corporation who's on the board of directors. And I think that the people would like an explanation of that, too. Now, I support thoroughly this whole impeachment inquiry and the testimonies. But what is the relationship between Hunter Biden's role on this energy commission and this whole impeachment inquiry?
Okay, so that's a really good question, Carol. And my own view is that Hunter Biden, because he has apparently been set in terms of the chatter about this, ought to have come forward. And I really believe that without him coming forward, that it's a missing piece that reasonable people can agree that they would need to make an informed decision. That's my opinion.
Yes.
But I will tell you just generally what I know about boards. So boards of directors of various corp. Now, this was not an American corporation, so it's not subject to American law. So the only analogy I can tell you is what American boards of directors are. And American boards of directors, when you're on a board, if it's a for-profit, it's very different than a not-for-profit. This was a for-profit company, and you have a duty to your shareholders. It's very simple.
Okay.
You're supposed to be representing your shareholders, and you're supposed to be oversight on behalf of the shareholders of the officers of the company who day-to-day operate the company. So your job as a director of a company is to be a check and balance on behalf of the shareholders who aren't there.
Okay.
And with respect to Hunter Biden, I think it's pretty clear that if his last name wasn't Biden, he probably would not have been asked to be on that board of directors. And so it begs the question, well, why did Ukraine or this company, this big oil and gas company, why did they think that it was advantageous for them to have Hunter Biden on their board when the man really is not an experienced energy person? And the answer is clearly political. I don't think we have to go to a library to look that up, Carol, right?
Okay. Yeah.
The idea is that if they had Hunter Biden on their board, that maybe if they needed to deliver a message to Joe Biden, they could do so. Or maybe by putting Hunter Biden on the board, they would make Joe Biden happy. And maybe that would be good. That would be a chit in their favor if they ever needed it. You know, just as Ivanka Trump has had all of her trademarks approved, she's gone to the head of the line with China. Why do you think that is, Carol?
Oh, okay.
Right?
Yes.
Because she's got the same last name. I mean, this is going on around the world with children of connected people trading on their parents. It happens in Hollywood all the time. All these people that are children of getting these star parts. Who would even give them a chance if they didn't have that last name? This is America. I mean, this is the world. This is the way it works. So do I think Hunter Biden got his position because of his name? I think he did.
Yes.
I think he did. But now when you ask, how does that relate to this? That's a really good question, Carol. Because how does Hunter Biden's appointment as a director on this relate at all to this impeachment? And here's how it relates, okay? The way it relates is that the accusation is that President Trump believed that if the Ukraine government would dig into this, that they might find some dirt. This is the allegation. And that the dirt would impugn the integrity of Joe Biden, who President Trump believed would be his rival to get reelected.
Okay.
You know, it's very interesting because a lot of people are talking about Nixon and what happened. And obviously Nixon wasn't impeached because he resigned rather than face what he thought was going to be impeachment. But if you really think about it, at the heart of it was the same drive to win. Because what was Watergate about? Watergate was about Richard Nixon, who was a shoo-in against McGovern. He was a shoo-in, but he didn't think so. So he created this slush fund to go and investigate the Democratic National Headquarters and break in. And the whole thing was ridiculous because, you know, he won by a landslide in 72. But at the time, he was afraid he might lose.
Yes.
And this is what happens with these people in office. Their ambition to win. They don't see anything else.
Wow. Thank you very much. Your explanation has enlightened me, and I'm sure many of your listeners.
And I thank you for calling, Carol. I really
thank you, Lisa.
Sure. It's 10:35. We'll be right back. WICC 600. We're going to have a fascinating, in-depth conversation with a woman whose life is just extraordinary. Helen Block, up on the Lisa Wexler Show. Stay tuned. And welcome back. Welcome back to the Lisa Wexler Show. It's 10:37 at 203-333-9422, 203-333-9422. So our guest who is joining us in studio right now, Helen Block, is a dear friend of mine. And I've known about her life and career, and I've watched it with such pride as she has turned into such an acclaimed writer. Her book, The Shoemaker's Daughter, getting rave reviews. And it is historical fiction, but it's based on a true life story. And Helen Block, welcome to the Lisa Wexler Show today. Hi. Thanks for joining us. Hi. It's great to have you here. So, Helen, let's get right into it a little bit, because I understand that you made a recent trip to Germany in which you spoke about your birth and your early childhood.
Yes, I did. And preface it with this following little story.
Sure.
So last year, summer of 2018, I receive in my email a trailer of a documentary that's in the works from 2G, Second Generation Children of Holocaust Survivors.
Is that the name of a group, 2G?
It's the name of the group, 2G, and it's been in Fairfield County probably active about 10 years. And when it started, I joined up. So when I receive information from them, I take a look at it, and I click on this, and all of a sudden I see that this documentary trailer is about Fahrenwald. Fahrenwald? That's where I was born. Why on earth are they making a documentary about the place that I'm born? So, of course, it immediately made me curious, and, of course, it brought me back to so many memories and so many things about my childhood. So I decided I was going to contact the woman who was in charge of making the documentary. Her name is Phyllis Lee. She lives in Manhattan. We had a very, very warm, wonderful meeting. She interviewed me in Brooklyn, New York. And then at the end of the interview, she says, oh, by the way, there's a museum opening in October 2018, and you're invited. Would you like to come?
2018 or 2019?
2018.
Okay.
So, of course, I had to make this decision, and I had very mixed feelings about it.
Had you been back to Germany?
I had been back to Germany with my husband and son. We went to Berlin, but I had never contemplated going back to Fahrenwald. First of all, how on earth did I think it was still in existence? Fahrenwald? I knew that it had closed in 1957 as a displaced persons camp. And I knew the origin of it in the first place because when I did the research, extensive research for the book that you mentioned, The Shoemaker's Daughter, I had learned that this was originally, Fahrenwald, which means pine forest, was originally created by the IG Farben Company for housing 2,500 units of housing for German workers creating munitions for the Nazis. during World War II.
So let's go back a little bit, and then we'll come forward again. So, Helen, what was the name you were born to? What's your name?
Well, I'm trying to go back to it, Lisa.
You want to be called Hinda?
I want to be called Hinda, and I started doing this.
You can change your name in my court.
Goody, I'm going to come and do it.
The Westport Probate Court. I'm the judge. You can change your name.
And you are, and you're a great judge, and I voted for you, of course.
Thank you, Helen.
All right. You know, it's really interesting. I was just sitting here for a couple of minutes, and immediately I learn something from you. I'm listening to your conversation about the goings on right now in the country, and I'm taking notes because I'm serious. I always learn things from you. So, yeah, I do. So I now have notes and a slightly different perspective, obviously, based on what it is that you said. So, yes, Hinda, I will come and do that. I was named Hinda in 1946, January, so now everybody knows exactly how ancient I am.
1946.
Yes, right.
And what was your last name?
My last name was Matushinska. So my birth certificate is Hinda Matushinska. And I, as...
And what is Matushinska? What is that, Czech? What is that?
Matushinsky is my father's name. The Matushinska is applied to females, is a Polish name.
Polish, okay.
So my origins are Polish. My parents both came from Poland and so forth. And you know my story because a while ago you interviewed me. I remember.
But our audience doesn't know.
Well, all right. Well, so my parents were married in 1940, just as the war was getting started, in a very small town called Ksiądz Wielki, possibly 50 kilometers from Krakow. And at that time, things were already heating up. My father had served in the Polish army, had been taken prisoner. They released the Jewish prisoners back to their hometowns for slave labor. My parents and their immediate family decided if they could hide, if they could escape from what was happening, which was already terrible, but who would have known what on earth was really going to take place? They found Polish farmers who helped them hide. And at a certain point, unfortunately, what my mother was very afraid of, that she would become pregnant and have a child, is exactly what happened. She did. And in the hiding place, to have a little girl who was already developing, who was speaking, who really, how could a child of 18 months understand that you had to remain silent during the day, that when you were hungry, you couldn't say anything, or if you cried, people would force their hands over your mouth to try to stifle you, because any noise whatsoever was going to be a giveaway. So my parents, unfortunately, had to make a decision, and the decision was that they would try to find an accommodation for my little sister. And my mother did, but unfortunately, the Poles were also quite threatened. They were not exactly esteemed by the Germans, and they were told that if they were hiding Jews, etc., there were signs everywhere that they too would be murdered.
Sure.
And so therefore...
They were afraid.
They were afraid, and the little girl was given up. When the little girl was given up...
Oh, the little girl was given up by the people that your parents entrusted her to?
Yes.
She was given up as a Jew to the Nazis?
She was given up to a Jew, to the Nazis, yeah. Yes. And obviously her fate was not a good one. And my parents were...
Could you imagine killing a two-year-old?
The thing is, there were a million Jewish children murdered during World War II. A million. And what it is that really gets people's attention somehow is not that figure of a million.
It's one.
It isn't. It's one.
It's one.
Exactly. It's one. And I think that's
because that's what we can get our head around. Can't get around a million.
You can't get around a million. You can't process it.
No.
It's just too impossible to imagine the pileup of that many little children. It's a large city in a country. It's an amazing thing that we can't, as you just said, wrap our minds around. So my parents split from this group. and they had to find another farmer, and they did.
His That's
name,
amazing.
His name was it. It was his name was Vlada Kukoric. He took my parents in, and they were hidden under very terrible circumstances. They were what my father and mother called a bunker, and it was actually an underground potato cellar that they themselves helped enlarge with pick and shovel when they first arrived. And they remained there for almost 2 years. So after liberation, in quotes, liberation, the Soviets came sweeping through that area earlier. It was January of 1945. They hobble back to their village. And what are they greeted with? "You're back? We thought you were dead." That was the greeting. And soon after that, the last close surviving relative that my father had, his brother, came back to town. He was looking for provisions and, of course, to be reunited with them. He was looking for provisions because he was going to get married again. He had lost his wife and two children in the war. He had survived. And this was not an uncommon thing. After the war, people who had lost everything, their loved ones, their immediate families, their friends, anything and everything that they had owned, they were bereft of anything. And so they needed that warmth and comfort. They needed something.
They needed something to live for.
Mm-hmm. And so he had come back. He had met his second cousin, and they were getting married. And that night when he went to find two chickens and some down feathers for her trousseau, he was murdered by the Poles.
This is after the war.
This is after the war.
We're chatting with Hinda Block.
Thank you, Lisa.
You're welcome. Hinda is my grandmother's name.
It's, you know,
Helen. Grandma Helen was Hinda. So every time she would refer to herself, she passed away at 106 and a half. She had a remarkable life.
Wow.
1899 to 2005.
Wow.
And never lost her mind. And never lost her teeth. And read without glasses and was never in a nursing home. This is my father's genes. Anyway, I think you have those genes. Anyway, but my father always says Hinda when he talks about his mother.
It's really.
So I cry when I say Hinda because I think of my grandma.
Well,
it's a Yiddish name.
Maybe one day we will both be grandmas. Who knows? Some way.
Can't rush it.
We're not rushing.
Can't rush them. No.
You know, they are not to be
rushed.
So I was named after my grandmother on my mother's side. And as a matter of fact, this is really, it's amazing. When I was doing that research for the book, I went to every single town in Poland that my parents had told me about. And I knew extensively about their stories because they were talkers. They weren't like a lot of parents, unfortunately, or fortunately, I don't know. Perhaps I knew too much. I probably did as a child. I'm sure it had quite a devastating effect on me. But of course, now I'm grateful.
Grateful.
Extremely grateful.
Because there are a lot of Holocaust 2G people whose parents didn't talk about their experiences.
Not at all. And they don't know.
But the symptoms of the trauma come out in other ways.
Absolutely. They absolutely do. I think what happened to me, and I talked a lot about it at my presentation, and it happened a lot when I finally decided to go to Germany for that opening of the museum and face the place that I had been born and lived, as you said, as a formative. It was my formative years.
Totally.
And
you lived till what? How old were you? Eight?
Actually, I was five and a half.
Five and a half. So until like kindergarten age.
I went there. I went to kindergarten there. And yes, I was.
What was your first language that you learned?
Yiddish. Yiddish was my first language. And I find it more and more important to me than ever. I go to the Yiddish Book Center in Amherst, Massachusetts to learn about my culture, more so than about the language, although I am conversant in Yiddish. I never lost it. But the culture is so utterly important. I was just there for a Sholem Ash retrospective about his writing, about his plays, Vengeance of God. We talked about it all weekend. There were people there from all walks of life. It was Mark Rothko's daughter was there.
That's cool.
Give you an an idea of the people who are interested in Yiddish culture and want to embrace it and know the power of it. But anyway, so I had gone back to this little village where my parents were born. I wanted a corroboration with regard to when they were here, their marriage, and so forth. My Polish guide from Krakow drove us there. We go to the administration building. It's about as big as your studio right here, so, you know, which is, and quite a bit more elegant, to say the least, all right? And we walk into this little building, and the Polish guide asks some questions. The man goes to the back of the room, pulls out from a metal cabinet these large marbled ledgers, some of them written in Russian, because, you know, the history of Poland was they were Lithuanian, they were Russian.
Always
they were
taken Poles, over.
Always taken over. And he finds the page where my parents' entry of their marriages. He types up for me a document on a Remington typewriter with those huge keys, one of which is broken and always sticking.
I love it.
And I find out that my grandmother Hinda's last name, I did not know, was Grinbaum. So I have this document, and I take it with me to corroborate their story. And it was absolutely true. And as a matter of fact, this brother that had been murdered, my father's brother, Yankel, he also, there's an entry for his marriage, which is, and I have a picture of that. I don't have a document, but
the first marriage, the one where he
lost the
children in the way. Yeah.
Exactly. So I have a photograph of
wow.
that. So all of these documentation things were very important for me, because I think when you write a book of fiction, and of course it is a novel, but it is so, as you said, based on absolute
the shoemaker's daughter, Hinda Block. It's 10:53. Would you stay around, Hinda?
I would.
We'll be right
be
back. And if you'd like to ask Hinda a question or comment, 203-333-9422 on the Lisa Wexler Show. Stay tuned. It's a few minutes before 11, 203-333-9422. As we rejoin Hinda Block, who I guess will be changing her name from Helen. Hinda is a very common Yiddish, I mean, when people were named in Yiddish Hinda, very often the English translation was Helen, as was my grandmother. But I want to hear from you, Hinda, about what you recall. You left at 5 and a half. You were born in 1946 in a displaced persons camp in Germany. And I want to hear what you recall. What are your earliest memories of being there? Like, what are the flashes of memory, the descriptions?
All right. Here's one flash of memory. When I went back, as I describe, the camp now is a Catholic settlement. And, of course, the houses are all renovated, and it looks totally different. But I made friends with one of the people there. Her name is Maria Manis, and during the time that the museum opening was in effect and so forth, they took us around and showed us the streets the way they used to be. Now, the streets when I lived there were named after the United States. So I lived on Indiana, 23 Indiana. So I remember that. I remember the back of the house, and I remember actually seeing my first wild animal there, which was a porcupine.
Really? Wild porcupines in Germany. What part of Germany were you at?
This is Bavaria, not too far from Munich,
okay.
near a town called Wolfratshausen from the 1200s. It's an ancient, ancient town.
Wow.
So that was one of my first memories. And somehow I knew enough not to go near its quills. I knew enough. I can almost remember its quills waving in the sunshine. And I stepped away. Another memory I have is my mother had a cousin who was in a DP camp near Paris. And she sent me a porcelain potty. Now, most of the children had metal potties, but I had a porcelain potty.
That's funny.
Yeah, it was rather funny. And we lived in a front room on the second floor. There was only one bathroom per house
okay.
of the units that were originally created for those German secret workers. And so at night, children, of course, had to have a potty because...
Sure.
So I decided that morning I was going to be independent and walk myself down the steps and empty my own potty. It didn't end so well.
Aww.
The potty broke. The shards of glass chopped off almost two of my fingers. You can still see the scars to this day. My mother, of course, hearing my screams, came running down the steps. We went to the hospital. Now, there was a hospital in Fehrenwald, which was one of the reasons that my mother and father wanted to go there, because my sister, who unfortunately did not survive, was a breech birth, and my mother was afraid that I would be a breech birth, and it was complicated. So, and I was.
And so you were able, so she was able to give birth in a hospital.
Right. So she was able to take me to this hospital, and I recall looking up and seeing the bright light and seeing that ether come down on me. And believe me, you never forget that. Never.
Helen Block, Hinda Block, the book is The Shoemaker's Daughter. Run out and get it on Amazon.com. And thank you for being with us today. It's 11 o'clock. We'll be right back.